Welcome to the Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
We are coming to you from the Hot Stove Society kitchen, our cooking school in downtown Seattle, 4th and Virginia, on the second story of the Hotel Andra, which is the landowner of Lola. That's where we lease our Lola restaurant from. So very excited to be here. We are doing our weekly show. It's 2 hours. We have a big show planned for you, or at least Madeline does. David Gremmels from Oregon Rogue Creamery is going to be here. I've been using that cheese for a million years.
I've been using that cheese for a long time, and you know what? See, this is what I learned about this show. Is I never knew it was from California. I thought it was from Oregon.
It is from Oregon.
Well, I mean, I thought it was from Northern California.
Okay. All right.
And then, okay. Anyway, we'll find out more.
We'll find out more about that. Chef's mental lapse there for a second. Jennifer Shea is going to be on the show today, and I knew her as Jennifer Heffernan Shea when she was a waitress at the Palace Kitchen a million years ago. See, I've been alive for a million years, and so that's why all these
Well, you and the dinosaurs.
She started Trophy Cupcakes and has been quite the success over the years and is starting a new campaign for Seattle Public Schools. Cities we miss. You know, Chef Maddie asked me what city that I missed because we've already done New Orleans and Chicago. Mm-hmm. So I went for New York. I hope that you're okay with
that. Oh, I'm totally fine. I miss New York.
It almost has to be broken down into like the five boroughs because there's so much in each place when it comes to food. But we're just going to go with the city today. We're going to chat with Alan Shapiro for the Seattle Cider Summit. And we have some tool thoughts for your holiday shopping and for big Thanksgiving shopping and things like that. And, of course, we're going to wrap things up with the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. My daughter, the legal counsel for our company, is going to be our challenger today.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
We're going to have a smarty pants in the house again.
Yeah. But does she know about food? That's the real question because these aren't legal questions.
Yeah.
Speaking of gadgets, yesterday in the middle of my cheesesteak, Election Day cheesesteak pop-up over at the dock in Ballard, at our to-go kitchen in Ballard.
Uh-huh.
Sitting there, and in between each batch, I can do 6 cheesesteaks at a time. And we had sold 200 cheesesteaks. And so I was
That's a lot of repetition.
Constant. And but every time I had to scrape the griddle, and all I had was a board scraper. And we're talking about tools today, right? So I had this little board scraper, and I'm trying to get all this stuff because of the steak meat, you know, the drippings brown to the griddle. And in between each batch, I have to scrape the griddle. And I've got this little board scraper, 6 inches long, 4 inches deep. My hands are burning. All the hot grease is splattering up on me. It's like, God. And Jackie walks up, and I said, will you go down to Cash and Carry and just see if they have a griddle scraper? And I had to draw a picture of what I was looking for her to run down there. It's only 3 blocks away, and to get this griddle scraper. Boom. 10 minutes later, she's back. It's the perfect tool. It's got a little razor top. It's the arm is bent so I can put pressure on it.
Right.
I scraped my griddle in like 2 seconds. All day long I'd been suffering, but the right tool, when I got the right tool, it was unbelievable.
Yeah,
changed my life.
Plus, it makes you like the job a lot more.
I know.
As opposed to hate it.
Now I have a little bit of a cramp in my back from where I scraped the griddle so often yesterday. So that's my Election Day histrionics. So it'd be. I guess we'll find out. Since we still don't know the outcome of the election, I guess we'll find out this weekend when you're listening to the show.
That's right.
You'll be able to say, Tom, Trump won, or Tom, Biden won, or whatever, because I don't know at this point.
Wait, what was the first thing? No, the second thing you said.
Well, depends on who's listening, I guess. I do know that this is our kind of election-free zone, our COVID-free zone. We love to talk about food and wine and all the good things in life when it comes to your kitchen and dining pleasures for 2 hours. So we try to stay out of all the other stuff for I mean, you can't stay out of it forever. Food is political. You know, whether
food is political.
Sometimes we talk about, you know, desert zones.
Correct.
Where people don't have access to good food. And that's a political thing. So.
Of course.
Or enough food for their families or all that kind of thing. Let's see.
Taste
of the week. I'm going to jump right in.
Okay, go ahead.
Because it's my lovely wife made French onion soup.
Oh.
With all the, you know, we picked our onions back in May, June.
Right.
And then let them dry to form a skin in the barn.
Right.
And now we've been using them all summer, and we're down to it.
Really, already?
We're down to it. Sadly, but true. But we use them on the dock all day.
Oh, yeah. So you use it at the
so we're down to it. And so she took the last of the ones we had at home anyway, the last dozen onions from Prosser and made onion soup the other day. We had a beautiful batch of beef stock reduction in the freezer. Nice. I got to say, I went to the store to get some Gruyere because I've always used Gruyere. And then you use Comté, right?
Comté, yeah.
They didn't have any Gruyere. All they had was pre-grated Gruyere. So I bought the Comté, and it was delicious. Here's the other thing I got to say about it. We made crostini out of the baguette.
Right.
Toasted them with butter and then toasted the cheese on the crostini.
Correct.
And then just drop those thin little things into the soup where they stay nice and crunchy. So typically French onion soup, you got the kind of the raw baguette right into the soup. So it's a much more soggy situation.
Correct.
I really like the toasted cracker.
Well, I like it too because it doesn't become quite as soggy.
Yeah, and it doesn't soak up your soup.
And it doesn't disappear because the bread in the onion soup usually disappears. But the idea of the bread in the onion soup has only... The main purpose was to just hold the cheese up there.
Yeah.
So you could put the whole ball under the salamander and give it that nice
gratiné. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and gratiné.
That's what we did. We put it under the broiler to get the cheese, the crostinis that way.
Right,
but
right.
Anyway, so you only have about a minute for your favorite taste of the week.
Well, do you remember Moni Casberg?
Yes.
She just came up with, she's selling espelette. She has this espelette connection, which is, espelette is a pepper from the Basque region of France. And hot and spicy, and she's making an aioli with espelette in it. She gave me a jar sample. 2 days. Gone. That stuff is like gold. Oh, my God. Smooth texture, gorgeous flavor, slightly spicy. I mean, the perfect tool to put on just about. Kathy made a wonderful...
Well, you can make some of your own. I have so much espelette that I can't use. You can make some of your own.
Oh, she would probably go in heaven with that one, too.
Yeah.
I mean, beautiful aioli. Oh, I just can't say enough. And then she has another jar of espelette puree, which is also super delicious, great tool, a little bit higher on spice, on heat, but gorgeous flavor and everything. Oh, congratulations to Moni. I think she might try to come on the show and talk about her product, so... We'll get her here. So anyway, that was my taste of the week because we cleaned that jar. It's like a 4-ounce jar. We cleaned it in 2 meals.
Awesome. I ran into Moni at the Met Market over in Mercer Island, I want to say, last time I saw Moni Casberg. Up next, David Gremmels is going to be here. He's from the Rogue Creamery. I've been using their blue cheese for a very long time. And I finally get to ask the source about a project I did at Cafe Sport. Cafe Sport.
Hopefully he's going to remember that far back.
32 years ago. So remind me to ask him that question.
Okay.
You're listening to the Hot Stove Society radio show right here on Cairo. We thank you for tuning in. Welcome back to the Cheesy Kitchen here at the Hot Stove Society radio show. I feel kind of blue. You know, it's funny because we just had a blue moon. We're going to talk blue cheese for a minute or two here at the hot stove. Our guest is David Gremmels. He is the proprietor, David, of the formerly Small Oregon Creamery, Rogue River. How are you today?
I'm well. Thank you, Tom. It's great to be on the show with you, and certainly look forward to time where we can gather at your restaurants again in the near future. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
Well, I don't know if you know, but I have been serving your cheese from the Rogue River. I've been serving it since Cafe Sport days, so that would be close to 40 years ago I started with that particular cheese. Not even really thinking about it so much from the American Farmstead cheese perspective, but just that it was local, and I always wanted to serve local foods.
Well, we really appreciate your support over 4 decades now.
And
Creamery is now into its 88th year, if you can believe it. Yeah. So there's many giants in cheese that I stand on the shoulders of that have helped us build these great recipes.
So tell us, Terry, how long have you been serving it?
Probably 30 years.
I
started at Rovers. And
oh, my gosh, Chef Terry, thank you. We really appreciate it. Over 3 decades.
Beautiful blue.
Fantastic.
You have a wonderful blue. It's very impressive, the quality and the creaminess and the mold flavor that you have acquired in that cheese is amazing.
Thank you. It's really a reflection of our landscape, of the beautiful pastures our cows graze on that are adjacent to the Rogue River.
David, tell us a little bit about the creamery. Tell us how you make a blue cheese, how it gets its kind of traditional flavors, how you store it, And I have, if we have time later in this segment, I have a little question to ask you about a project I did 30-some years ago at Cafe Sports. So why don't you get started on the creamery
itself? Yeah. So, you know, it really starts with milk. Milk really reflects the landscape. With the soil our pastures are growing on, and certainly the water, which comes from the Great Rogue River, and the moderate climate. Our cows are grazing 10 months a year on our pastures.
Wow.
And so it's really a focus on quality milk. And the less we do to the milk, the better. So we don't standardize. We just really gently heat the milk, add our cultures that came over from France in the 1950s, and we continue using the same strain today. And we coagulate the vat and the milk using vegetarian organic enzymes. So those are mushroom-based, and so that's where you're getting a lot of umami expressed. And the Penicillin Roque 40, the mold that we introduce into the vat of milk, also came over from France in the 50s. So our caves have been operating, as I shared, the creamery has been operating for 88 years. So they're man-made caves, but the caves express flavor of molds and fungus and bacteria, and that famous regional bacteria, which we call Breve bacterium, that adds that savory note and flavor to our cheese. So, and as the cheese ages, in the case of the Rogue River Blue, a year, and there's a process of protolysis that occurs that really creates a creaminess. And and because of the acidity of our cheese, we also get a lovely brucheite crystal. Mm-hmm. So there's this texture in it as well. So it's really an expression of this region. So thereby, Oregon Blue, Oregon Zola, Crater Lake Blue, our famed Smoky Blue, and Rogue River Blue.
Wow.
What a lineup.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, Terry, when I have Roquefort, say, to me, it's a sheep's milk cheese, right?
Right.
And it's a much firmer texture than this Oregon Blue. And that's one of the cool things about Oregon Blue is it's more custardy, I would say. On
creamy.
Kind of on an aged Stilton kind of basis.
Right.
But the idea in my mind, you know, forever, this cheese has been so affordable.
Correct.
And so delicious at the same time. You know, when you're buying Colston Bassett Stilton or something, you're paying $25-$30 a pound for
right.
it. But your cheese, David, is so regionally affordable. I find that an amazing, you know, with the quality and affordability, it's an amazing combination.
Thank you. We're really getting a cheese that's approachable and certainly organic. Our herd, our pastures, and our make process is organically certified. And we're also a B Corp, and that means we're making a difference environmentally, socially, and economically, one wheel at a time.
That's awesome.
So what does that mean, a B Corp?
So B Corps are worldwide. They're businesses that have created articles of incorporation that uses business as a force of good. In their community, socially, and economically, environmentally, in all that we do. So using profits a little differently, to create an equitable, future that's, supporting, our community and the environment and, working to preserve our valuable resources for our future generations.
Very, very commendable.
Yep, absolutely. And you've
Thank
also
you.
Been
well,
called the world's best cheese.
I love hearing that. Thank you.
I mean, who gave you that honor? Who bestowed that on you? It's like knighting somebody.
That was news that came nearly a year ago from Bergamo, Italy, from the World Cheese Awards. There were 3,804 cheeses from around the world, from six continents, 42 countries, and there were just over 260 judges gathered to judge the cheese. And wasn't there, but the cheese really represented America well.
Yes.
It was.
Why?
Crowned the best cheese in the world.
Which one of your lineup was that?
It's the Rogue River Blue. The seasonal blue that we create in the autumnal, starting on the autumnal equinox and finish before the winter solstice, and wrap in the biodynamic organic grape leaves that we pick at Calhorn Vineyard and soak in house-made pear liqueur.
Well, that leads me into my final question, Chef Terry, for David Grimmels from Rogue River Creamery. About 35 years ago or so, I took three 5-pound wheels of the Rogue River Blue, just the basic stuff, and I wanted to age them longer for some reason. This is back at Cafe Sport days, and I took a beautiful bottle of Riesling, a nice vintner's choice, like a sweet Riesling from Washington, and I put the 5-pound wheel and I poured a bottle of the Gewürztraminer, actually it was a Gewürztraminer, not Riesling, into the bag, and I let it sit for 6 months, and then I turned it every month just so that the cheese would kind of wash the rind and swish it. But I did keep it airtight, and I kept it in the wine cellar. David, it was so good when I pulled it out. I didn't know if I was going to die eating it or if it was actually somehow or another going to be a revelation. It turned out to be a revelation. What do you think of that? You only have 20 seconds.
I love it. And we've actually recreated it. And it's called Blue Horn. And also, it's exclusive to Whole Foods and the brand Enraptured Blanc. It'll be available during the 12 days of cheese giving in December.
Well, see, there you go, Chef
Tom Douglas.
There you go, Chef.
And that's your percentage, Tom.
So there's some telepathy happening here. Good. We're on the same level. No, it takes it to another level. It just adds such a sweet fruitiness to it.
Oh, yeah, it really did.
And caramelizes the cheese in a way that I've never experienced. So you get that fruit, you get that savory, but you also get those caramel notes as a result of the wine being introduced to the cheese. That's remarkable. So we're thinking on the same level here. That's great.
That's awesome.
So
if you get a chance, go for the 12 days of cheese during the Christmas season. Mm-hmm. Also, David, thank you for being on the show. That's David Grimmels from the Rogue Creamery Cheese Company down there in Oregon.
Fantastic blue, and keep on cheesing.
Thank you so much, Chef. I really appreciate the honor. It's been an honor to be on the station with you. Thank you.
Congratulations.
All right, up next, the cities we miss. New York City is in our sights on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. All right, we're back in the Hot Stove Kitchen. I'm Tom Douglas.
And I'm Terry Roturo, the chef in a hat.
If you're watching us live taping the show, you can watch Chef Terry take down a butternut squash. So we're talking
about... I did take it down.
You did take it down. You are the master. That squash has nothing on you. Anyway, we talk each week about a city that we have missed during our COVID quarantine. And... because we're both travelers. We both love it. I think we travel as much for business as we do just to eat in restaurants all over the world, right?
I think so, too, yes.
Yeah. We are food travelers.
I think no matter what, there is not a travel that does not involve eating. I mean, that's been my life and your life.
But don't you travel sometimes to a city just for a particular restaurant?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
No, of course. No, I mean, and I think New York would be... I don't think I remember, well, a few times maybe, but in general, I don't go to New York thinking, oh, I'm going to go visit New York. I go to New York going, okay, where am I going
to
eat?
I can't wait to go to La Bernardin. Yeah. Or
All those different restaurants.
So let's talk about that, because Maddie is in charge. Madeline, our producer, is in charge to entice us with some new joints. But you and I have favorites. We have friends over the years that we've made. Matter of fact, I saw Marcus Samuelson on the Today Show yesterday. Making roast chicken and then turning the carcass into soup and things like that. But Marcus is one of those survivors, right? He is a beautifully spoken, very handsome, very nice man,
right.
a good person. So he was wearing his red rooster apron, and it reminded me of taking the, I don't know what is it. I don't think it's the A train. It could be the B train or something, all the way up to the Red Rooster up in Harlem.
To the Bronx, yeah.
No, to Harlem.
Oh, Harlem, yeah. Yes.
Getting off the train, and I'd never been to Harlem until then. I'd driven through, but I'd never really been to Harlem. And it just was a slice of life, and it was super cool. And walked right in, sat at the bar. He has a big counter in there, and sat at the bar and ordered my food, and just saw a real slice of Americana sitting in that restaurant. And I thought it was very cool.
Yeah,
I can't wait to go back.
Yeah, just the location itself is cool. Yeah,
yeah.
One of my fondest memory of eating in New York, besides the one we just named, obviously. But is the Fatty Crab in the Village. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been to the Fatty Crab?
Is it still open?
I think the one on the north end is closed. I think the one in the Village might still be open.
I thought he closed one of
the
those.
The one on the north end and across from, what's that famous deli? Zebar.
Uh-huh. Like
somewhere around Zebar, across the street, there was one, but it's closed. But the one down in the Village, small place.
Very small.
Kind of like Poe.
I barely fit in there myself.
But I remember going there with Ryan, my oldest son. I had asked him, you know, let's take a trip. And I said, where do you want to go? He said, New York. So we went to New York, and I took him the Fatty Crab for dinner. And it was just, I had been there before, and I love that place. I think it's really like Indonesian. It's got all kind of different flair from Southeast Asia. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things that I introduced him to was raw quail egg testing. 5 different quail egg, and every single one of them spicier than the other. And, you know, slowly but surely going up to hard heat.
Right.
The first time I had that, I was like, whew, 5 raw quail egg. Don't know if I can handle all this.
No problem.
So I took this, and it was so delicious. I mean, many, you know, other dishes, obviously, but that was one of the highlights and fun highlights. And also, you know, having some wine.
You mentioned Zabar's. Up in that same neighborhood is Barney Greengrass, which is a classic Jewish deli / restaurant. Yep. And my friend Ed Levine, who co-wrote Big Dinners with me, took me there for the first time maybe 8-10 years ago. And, you know, I love that Jewish deli thing. Russ and Daughters is my favorite down there on Houston. But it is such a treat to see a real authentic New York Jewish deli.
Yeah. Well, they have quite a few, actually, in New York, which is probably the only,
not as many as they used to. It's a dying breed.
Well, like anything else.
What about some of the high-end places? Like John George von Richten's John George. Danielle is still opening restaurants, and he must be getting 65, 70 years old.
No. Danielle is 60 years old.
60 years old?
Yeah. Oh, 62, sorry. Yeah. He's your age.
He's my age. Wow, he's getting up there then.
Yeah. But he's not doing Philly cheesecake.
No, he's not. On the dock in Ballard.
He's opening in Dubai. He just recently opened in Dubai. And he's opening at that new tower on, you know, somewhere in downtown Manhattan. But Le Bernardin. I mean, Eric is a good dear friend, and I've had so many meals at Le Bernardin. Danielle and Eric are usually like, I have to stop and say hi at least.
I know.
And usually it ends up being a 5-6 course meal sitting down, you know, in the restaurant or at the bar or whatever. But what wonderful, wonderful restaurants for fine dining. You know, these are like top fine dining restaurants.
Well, Le Bernardin, since its inception, has been rated one of the top restaurants in the world.
Right.
My favorite thing to do at Le Bernardin is get off the flight, and then I kind of go around. You know, you're ready to walk after you get off a 6-hour flight, and I walk around the city, and then by about 1:30 or so, I head to Le Bernardin, and the lunch crowd is in, right?
You
it's
know
about
the cook,
a 12:30,
you know the 1 cooks
o'clock.
Hate you, right?
I know. And so 1:30, 2 o'clock, I show up, and then I sit in the bar, and I have a nice, slow lunch all the way until happy hour, 5 or 6 p.m., and then, you know, beautiful wine, lovely seafood, so it's not too heavy.
Right.
And then I go out maybe 8 or 9 o'clock for a beautiful dinner. So that is a lovely way to enjoy your first day in New York City.
The only time I canceled my dinner, I remember this. Actually, it was a dinner, early dinner, 7 o'clock at Le Bernardin. The only time I canceled to Eric was the day I had brunch the same day at Per Se.
Uh-huh.
And they decided
at Per Se?
At Per Se. I landed in New York. Went straight up to my hotel, dropped the luggage, took a shower, and then walked up to a Columbus Circle. and went to Pursey, and I met a friend of mine who was driving down from Connecticut. Anyway, we met out there, went to the kitchen, say hi to everybody, and then they decided to do like a 30-course brunch. It's one of the few times in my life where at the end of the meal, they brought a beautiful silver tray with 30 little petit four, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, no, please. I cannot put anything else in my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, right now. And we came out of the restaurant. We got it there around noon. We got out there at 5:30, and I called Eric. I said, I don't think I can do another dinner like this in an hour from now. I was like...
You know, after Pete Wells did his takedown of Percy for... Uh-huh. For really just kind of being snotty, I guess, is right. At the end of the day, some things weren't right food-wise, but it was more about they recognized him and then treated him different than some of the other diners and restaurants and stuff like that. So, but my personal experience there was fine, but it's also why I don't go to restaurants like that.
Right.
I don't even set myself up for that anymore. It's just not my style, right? It's just... very shishy in your face. I'd much prefer a fatty crab, like you talked about.
Of course.
David Chang's restaurants are much more my style, right? As you know. Yeah, that's uncomfortable plywood chairs. It's counter eating.
They're meant for a purpose only.
Yeah,
don't sit here for hours.
Turn the table. Madeline, you've heard about some of our dreams, some of the ones that we went to that we can't wait to get back to see. What's striking you now? What are you hearing about? The best restaurants, new places?
Last time I was in New York was with you. About a year ago, we were there for the Nordstrom opening.
Oh, that's right.
So we went there and hate. Unfortunately, the Fatty Crab is permanently closed, Thierry.
Oh.
I did look it up. I know. So we'll have to sort of channel that deliciousness. I've seen a couple new things coming up. We were talking about fine dining. And actually, an 11 Madison Park alum, Connie Chung, has funneled her years of fine dining. She just opened up Milu just off Park Avenue. And they are doing a... roast duck over duck fat rice. That just makes me want to eat everything now.
You know who Milu was or Milu is?
No.
Do you ever heard of a cartoon called Tintin?
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Milu is the dog.
There you go. I'm sure maybe it's named after there. I like it. They're also highlighting a bunch of new spots that have opened up in Brooklyn. The Food Sermon Kitchen looks delicious. They're doing a lot of cool jerk chicken and oxtail recipes, and they are just right in the heart of Brooklyn, just outside of Williamsburg area, doing whole lamb shakes, also to-go offerings and outdoor seating. So there's a lot of cool stuff going on.
I know,
only downtown. But I love Charlie Bird. That's one of my all-time favorite restaurants there. I just, similar to Tom, this casual, fun vibe, amazing soundtrack, awesome artwork, great wine list.
I think you and I went to Charlie Bird together when we were there for the James Beard Awards, if I'm not mistaken.
Maybe it was,
event, a St. Michelle event or something.
Something like that, It's one of my all-time go-to right off the plane. Walk around there, and they do a delicious... I think they kind of... really cemented that delicious, acidic, fresh farro salad, you know, just the nice bitter greens and olive oil, sea salt. That's, I think, what they're known for. A little bit of Parmesan. It's great.
Is that East Village?
It is, yes.
I think it's East Village.
So,
yeah, right in that area. So many good places in New York. We'll have to revisit New York.
We could spend weeks on
New
York.
We should go by which airport we go into. If we go into Newark or JFK or LaGuardia, then what's your first stop right there in Manhattan? So much fun. I can't wait to travel again. It's going to be so exciting. Next week, I'm going to Scottsdale, Arizona to play a little golf for 2 days. Very exciting. My friend's taking me down.
Cool.
Like that. Up next, Jennifer Shea is going to be here from Trophy Cupcakes. We're going to talk about all the different things that she's up to on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome to the Hot Stove Society Show, the Cupcake Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Thierry Rotiro, also in the Cupcake Kitchen.
We are joined by Jennifer Shea today from Trophy Cupcakes, and I always want to take my Tahoe, when I see those little trophy cupcake trucks running around town and ram into the side of it and make off like a heist of an armored truck with all the cupcakes.
That would make the news across the country.
I think it would. If we ever we need more publicity, we might just want to set that up.
Let's set that up.
Story.
And then we send out an APB for the frosting-coated Chevy Tahoe.
62-year-old frustrated restaurateur hits cupcake truck and runs away with dozens.
Low blood sugar. Yeah. At its worst.
Jennifer, you and I worked together many moons ago. I'm so happy for your success, and you continue to go out there and do things for our town that are super important. And so we thought we'd like to spread some sweetness about what you're doing for Seattle Public Schools.
Thank you. It's great to be here. And yes, I had such a great time being one of the openers of Palace Kitchen all those years ago. Just a time that I look back on with so much joy. We had a lot of fun there.
We really did.
Yeah, it was great. So Trophy Cupcakes, our mission has always been spreading sweetness and joy around the community. I mean, how can you not when you bake cupcakes? But, you know, with the pandemic, our mission has really come into full focus for us. I think my team more than ever has really realized what I've meant all these years when I say we're spreading love one cupcake at a time. We primarily went straight into delivery only, no contact when the pandemic hit. And we saw, you know, people bursting into tears when we're delivering cupcakes to their door. So it really has been amazing.
Yeah.
We started to pay it forward right in the beginning and donated, with our community's help, 28,000 cupcakes to first responders. And that whole idea was, Xiao Qing commented on one of my Instagram posts. She's been in your kitchen many times, and said, you know, I want to pay it forward. And this whole idea blossomed. And then, it really just evolved into who can we help next. And I found out that Seattle Public Schools provides 30,000 free meals to families all over Seattle. And with school not being in session, all of the children who qualify for that, you know, are having food scarcity issues more than ever. And we just thought if we pivoted our campaign to Seattle Public Schools, we could really, you know, just bring a little extra sweetness to some families' lives. And it's been really amazing, the reaction. Uh-huh. I've been out there, you know, giving cupcakes to kids, and I don't know, it's just amazing.
I know cupcakes were my favorite thing. I would always break off the bottom of the cupcake, the cake part, and throw it away and just eat the top frosted part.
Oh, really? I keep on thinking I need to make an infographic of, you know, all the ways to eat a cupcake, you know, because there's the sandwich method of turning the top over and then eating it. You know, it's pretty fascinating to sit and watch, you know, a group of people eat cupcakes. I think they all do it different.
A big bowl of whipped cream and then you turn it upside down and dunk into that. I think that would be lovely to eat.
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell us how people get involved. Is it simply just going onto your site and ordering cupcakes and automatically you give some to the public schools, or what's the process?
So the process is hopping on our website. You'll see the Pay It Forward Seattle Public Schools right there, and, you know, really big on the front of our website. Click on that and you can order as many cupcakes as you want. And those go directly to our weekly drops at Seattle Public Schools. And then the other sweet part of that is that Trophy matches your donation. So if you buy one cupcake, you're actually donating two. And so we're hoping that we can, you know, provide as many cupcakes as possible across the Seattle Public Schools, because the need is great. And, you know, I think we've done a couple thousand so far in the past 3 weeks, and we're booked, you know, through December for a school a week.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so really easy, yeah.
You know, one of the things I like about it, too, is it helps let you keep your team busy and employed. And, you know, during this time, that's as important as anything.
Yeah, and I mean, in the beginning when Xiao Qing said, you know, can I pay it forward? And I really started thinking about how to do this. I I just, it dawned on me that our fans, just like your fans, they want to help. When people hear the restaurants that are closing, it's obviously incredibly heartbreaking to all of us. And so I just decided to be vulnerable and ask for help in the beginning. And our fans just showed up for us, which is, was just so incredible. And we said that, you know, if you buy cupcakes, we will match it. We can donate them to first responders, now to Seattle Public Schools. And this is keeping us open. It's really helping us have some sales come through the door. So you're really doing two things. You're supporting Seattle Public Schools. You're supporting small business and bringing, like I said, that joy to families' lives that just, you know, need a little extra joy right now. I mean, everybody just needs a little something special right now.
I know we're doing a little bit the same thing. And so obviously what it does for me is it helps me stay in business and helps me pay my team, because it helps pay a baseline cook in our kitchen to stay there. The $20 isn't a donation. It is, between cooking and rent and everything else, it's what it costs to produce that meal. And so it helps me keep a team on staff. And so that's awesome. And I love the fact that people think about it, they're literally trying to keep a small business in business. So
yeah, just like we're doing a dollar per order you do online for Luke. Mm-hmm. A dollar goes to Food Lifeline. Mm-hmm. That's four meals or five meals, you know, that somebody gets out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Jennifer, let's get back down to brass tacks real quick. I mean, all this good stuff is fine, but what's your favorite flavor right now?
Oh, gosh, that is always such a hard question for me. It's like, you know, saying which child is your favorite.
Oh,
you know?
Come on. Be real. Come on. We have a favorite.
I also have an only child, so it's much easier for me. I think right now my favorite is our seasonal flavor, pumpkin pie. And it is real pumpkin pie stuffed inside of pumpkin cake. It has a graham cracker crust. It has pumpkin pie buttercream with maple buttercream on top of that. Just tastes like fall. Super. Yeah,
you get me a buttercream. I'm good.
So literally, there's you put the crust and the pumpkin pie filling right inside your cupcake.
Yeah. So the crust goes in the bottom, just like if you were making a little pie.
See. Yeah.
You par bake that. The cake batter goes in. That bakes off. We bake the pumpkin pie crustless in a, another pan, and then that gets scooped into the middle. So you've got that real pumpkin pie center, and then the pumpkin pie also gets blended into the buttercream.
That's so it's a lot
like
of labor.
Very, oh, I know that.
Wow. You're making it really hard on yourself. That's awesome.
Well, we would suggest here, Terry and I would suggest you get out there and order some Trophy cupcakes and help Seattle Public Schools, help Trophy, and enjoy your holiday season with a little sweet surprise. Thank you, Jennifer.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Happy holidays.
Both of you. Yeah, you too. I'm starting today. Christmas and Thanksgiving, it all starts now.
It all starts now. Up next, we're going to chat with Alan Shapiro of the Cider Summit in Seattle, plus the start of our Thanksgiving boot camp. We're kicking things off with Stuffing on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM. Tom Douglas and Chef in the Chapeau over there cooking away butternut squash.
That's right. In brown butter.
In this hour, we're going to kick off our Thanksgiving boot camp segment with stuffing recipe ideas, leftover plans. We'll also be sure to your kitchen is stocked up with essential tools for the holiday feast. And finally, we're going to wrap up with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia Challenge brought to you by Rub With Love Spice Rubs. First, let's chat with Alan Shapiro. Alan is from the Seattle Cider Summit and their virtual pivot this year on how they're dealing with both the holidays and the pandemic. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate you having me on.
All right. Tell us about your Cider Summit and what's going on in the whole cider world.
Well, we started Cider Summit Seattle back in 2010 just as a way to bring kind of a attention and awareness and sampling opportunity for, what was just this emerging kind of artisanal segment, primarily in the Northwest. And so we created that in South Lake Union area, had a few hundred people show up, much to our surprise. And so we grew steadily over the next 10 years and to from that first few hundred people to closer to 3,000 people as we celebrated our 10th anniversary last year. And we grew from, you know, scrambling to find maybe 40 ciders to offer at the festival to now having to limit it to about 175 offerings.
Amazing.
From so it's been exciting growth. And then, of course, the world changed dramatically on us over the last several months. And so this year we decided to go to kind of the curated festival to go tasting kits, which we combine with an online virtual tasting event featuring, you know, most of the participating cider makers.
Super fun idea. I would do that in a heartbeat. Tell us about the two kits that you're offering.
Right. So, you know, for this time of year, we wanted to focus on harvest and holiday. We call our main one, and that's a selection of Washington cider makers, 7 out of 8, both a combination of kind of what I would call the more modern styles, you know, kind of new wave flavored spice things, and the other half being a little bit more kind of classic, more artisanal styles. And so that kit comes with 8 ciders, 2 tasting glasses. We've got apple and pear shaped stress balls, which could come in handy. And, you know, alcohol and stress balls, kind of useful. And also EOS has come on board as a partner. People have the option of adding on their Taste of Washington caramel selection, which is kind of create some fun pairings. And our second kit we're calling Pomo and Dessert Cider. And so that's something very different and very kind of specialized. So Pomo, you know, very traditional French drink, which has found a new home in Northwest as well, right? Traditionally a blend of Calvados, French apple brandy, and freshly pressed apple juice. And so it's a little bit higher alcohol and intensely flavored, but really, you know, beautiful, beautiful beverage and kind of a rare opportunity for people to get their hands on those selections as well.
And then, so if people want to buy these, where do they go? And then when do they follow along with the tasting?
Right. So people can head to cidersummit.com and click on the Seattle tab, and they'll pull up all the info on what's included in those kits and the pickup and delivery options for those. We need everyone to order by midnight on November 11th. So 11:59 p.m. on November 11th. And the kits will be available for pickup between November 20th and 25th at the Woods Tasting Room at Seattle Cider in Soto. So just in time for Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm. I have a question. Can you repeat the website? Because I have cidersummitnorthwest.com. Is that right?
Yeah, cidersummit.com forwards to that URL, so automatically. And I think I neglected to mention the virtual component of it will take place on November 21st from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. So when people get their confirmation email of the purchase of their kits, we'll include all the login information for that Zoom event.
Super fun. You know, cider took forever to take off. Everyone kept predicting it maybe 20, 30 40 years ago.
Yeah, and we were talking about 30 years ago about cider picking up.
Yeah, especially in the Northwest, you know, where there's so many apples. And it finally has, in the last 10 years, I would say, it finally really has taken on its own identity and become a super important beverage in Washington State.
There were a couple of false starts along the way. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, I must say, and I remember the first, when you were talking about the events, the first annual event towards South Lake Union there, where we had food and cider, and I was astonished by how many people showed up the first year.
You and me both. We had no idea if anyone was going to show up.
No, I mean, I was really thrilled because I don't remember, you know, what's his name? I forgot his name now. The guy who was in charge of it, but who called me to participate in it. But we were both like, well, we'll see what happened. Man, I was stunned. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of people at that event, and I was like, wow, that's cool. Cider is picking up. And I was like, yeah, you're right. That was about 10 years ago.
So right, and that actually gave us some encouragement to expand into more cities. So we grew to Portland in 2011, Chicago to coincide with an industry conference in 2014, and then the Bay Area Chicago's 2013 and the Bay Area 2014. So we had, up until this year, been producing four annual events. Hopefully have been a good partner in working with the cider makers and the cider associations to help that category grow and build trial awareness, which was kind of the mission from day one.
That's awesome.
So, Alan, we only have a minute, but if you were to go out today to one of the local groceries here in town, what cider would you pick up for Thanksgiving? Do you want something more of an everyday cider because you have so many different food items, or do you have a specialty cider for Thanksgiving that you would buy?
You know, I prefer kind of a drier, elegant, almost more champagne style ciders. Just a personal preference. I think sometimes the things that are heavily dosed with fruit can compete a little too much rather than complement some of the flavors. Yeah. I always head in that direction.
I don't want to get you in trouble with asking a brand name, but come on, give us a brand name.
Oh, yeah, you're going to make me alienate some of my friends. So I, among the Washington cideries, I love the range from Finn River over in Chimicum.
They do a good job, those guys.
Yeah, and they have just a really terrific, you know, farm-based mission there, and they've been fantastic partners of the festival from day one. So you can't go wrong with their stuff.
All right,
cool.
And I apologize to everyone else that I left off.
Alan Shapiro from the Northwest Cider Summit, CiderSummitNorthwest.com. Thank you so much for your time. Up next, it's time to talk stuffing at our Thanksgiving radio show, Hot Stove Boot Camp, on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back. Hot Stove Society show on Cairo Radio. Chef Terry is over there starting a mustard vinaigrette for our butternut squash and grilled radicchio salad that we're making live during the show today. If you ever want to join us live, just go to Facebook and look for us on Wednesday mornings live, right? Is that Madeline? How else is there a key that they need to look for, or what?
Nope. We're streaming live on our Facebook page, Hot Stove Radio. All right. So search for Hot Stove Radio, and we'll be live, you know, next week, actually, we'll be taping on Friday. So Friday the 13th will be
9 to 11.
Friday the 13th.
Yeah. You know why we're doing that? Because somebody has to be in Scottsdale to play around the golf on
somebody. Well,
that somebody's not me.
That's somebody's not me either. I'd be working my butt off. That's
yeah,
okay.
Exactly. We all will be.
Yeah, all right, me too, on the golf course. I've earned it. After my cheesesteak facial yesterday, 200 cheesesteaks, I've earned a day off. Let's see. It's time to talk stuffing. Madeline, what did you have in mind for this? Other than I have some really good stuffing ideas. On Sunday, I made three different stuffings.
Woo!
I'm doing this series of Thanksgiving classes at Hot Stove Virtual. And so I had to do the recipe so I knew what ingredients and techniques to send out to the people that sign up for class.
Yeah.
So I did all these three stuffings and gotta say, they came out pretty good, if I do say so myself.
Stuffing's my favorite. Yeah. You know, this segment is going to be all month long as we gear up for the big food holiday that is Thanksgiving. So every week we're going to tackle a course for our Thanksgiving boot camp, and we thought we would kick it off with stuffing. So the idea is to give...
Now, wait a second. Do you consider stuffing a course?
Absolutely. I would have a whole plate of just stuffing. You know what I mean. I guess a category of food with Thanksgiving. And
it's one of the plates on the buffet is what you mean.
Exactly. It's a course. Whether you're running the course or eating the course there. But I think people are eager to hear, do you want to go traditional? Do you want to go trendy? What to prep in advance? What's going to be easiest? And then also what to do with leftovers if there are any leftovers.
There are any leftovers. Well, I'll tell you, my favorite stuffing recipe is I put in the Tom's Big Dinner books, and it's a Christmas Eve dinner at the Dow. So for years and years and years, we have had gone to Madeline's parents' house to celebrate Christmas Eve. And I made a whole dinner based on that as a chapter in Tom's Big Dinners. And so Madeline knows this stuffing well, the King Bolita stuffing. So basically it's a porcini stuffing with, dried fruits and nuts and country bread and lots of good turkey stock and all that kind of stuff. Chef, we only have That's enough shallot for like 18, 20 people. Anyway, so that's my favorite.
And
For our listeners, the first person who sent us a little ask a question right now, from now going forward, I'm going to send a copy of Tom's Big Dinners and my King Bolitas stuffing recipe to them right now. So Madeline's on the Madeline's doing this. And I'll match it for our radio show listeners. I'll match that this weekend as we talk. So
when I was a kid, my mom used to make a bread stuffing. So using, you know, bread, the white part of the bread, and even the crust, some of the crust, make little cubes, and then mix a little bit of stock and mushrooms and onions and carrots, and use that and put that in the bird. And no, we didn't celebrate Thanksgiving, but we did stuff turkey from time to time, or stuff goose, and then put that in the oven and cook it that way. And I've never been an inside stuffing kind of guy.
Yeah.
I like to make it I learned to make it in this country on the side, which is much more preferable because you can control it better. Mm-hmm. Also, it doesn't come out as this big mush.
Yeah, and it gets crusty around the edges.
And when I met Kathy, you know, after a few Thanksgiving, she was doing a wild rice stuffing, which I thought was always really cool. So it's like wild rice, sauteed mushroom, all kind of different stocks and vegetables. And that was the stuffing on the side. And I thought, oh, that's pretty cool. You know, it's very healthy and very, not quite as just a pile of bread, you know, stuffing. So I'm a big fan of chestnut. I like chestnut and mushroom together.
Mm-hmm.
Roasted chestnut, chop them down. Sauteed mushroom, chop them down. Put everything together and make that your base of stuffing. So you put that into either a rice or even with some breading. Meaning it's some diced bread and a little stock, and put that in the oven for just 30 minutes, and then you have this beautiful kind of bread pudding kind of idea where you use that as a stuffing, you spoon it out.
Mm-hmm. I made a cornbread stuffing this weekend for my class coming up, and it reminded me a couple of different things about stuffing that I find important. One is when I made my cornbread base, which, of course, you have to make cornbread in order to have the cornbread stuffing, I used the cast iron pan with bacon and duck fat.
Right.
It got it fairly hot so that when I poured my corn batter, bread batter into the pan, it just sizzled completely, right? And then I popped that whole thing into the oven. And you get that beautiful brown crustiness.
Correct.
And, of course, you get a little bit of the smoky bacon flavor. And that was the base for my stuffing. So already I'm a step ahead as far as depth of flavor goes because I'm getting that, number one, the brown, number two, the bacon and duck fat a little bit incorporated into that.
And also a little change of texture on the outside that's a bit drier than the inside. And
yeah, so that when you do a scoop out. So then I took it and I added toasted almonds. I added dried fruits like raisins, golden raisins. But then I also cut up a fresh apple. And toss the whole thing with fresh apple. But it didn't cook that. You know, pecan halves. I think the cornbread had the pecan. I think the almonds were in the wilder. I made so many stuffings this weekend. But then you just put it into a pan, like a casserole, like you would do any sort of stuffing on the side.
Right.
Put a little stock over top and then slow bake it.
Right.
So that you end up with that cool, good, delicious crustiness all the way around the outside. Again, double crust is what you call it. Double crust stuffing.
It's really...
Yeah.
I mean, the beautiful thing, I think, that we have in the Northwest, I don't know some other part of the country, but here we have, like you mentioned, apple, we have cranberries, we still have huckleberries and things like this. So, and the mushroom, of course. So if you have the chance to have wild chanterelle right now, put them away, you know, put them in the freezer and then use them for your stuffing for Thanksgiving, you know, you can definitely do a good job. Now, I would tell you that I would prefer to saute them now.
Absolutely.
And put them in the freezer sauteed. Versus don't put them raw in the freezer.
Here's my problem with the chanterelle a little bit. They're so mild that they, in my mind, in a stuffing that has lots of herbs and, you know, I just mentioned all the different flavors of the fats and the dried fruits and the nuts. I just don't think they show up. So to me, it's a better time
to use
your...
It's more textural than anything else.
Yeah, to me, it's a better time to use your dried porcinis, your dried morels and things like that. Because you can, when you rehydrate them, you actually make a broth and that can then go over all of your stuffing and... And so that, to me, this is a perfect time to use dried mushrooms.
Right. And if you're going to use a chicken stock to put in your breading, use the chicken stock to soak your dried mushroom.
Right.
So like this, you have a more intense flavor in your stock, and then you get all that through. So.
Now, I made a wild rice stuffing this weekend that after I finished it, I would have gone back and I would have cooked my wild rice more. It was somewhat tender, But it didn't blow up. You know how wild rice can puff up like almost like popcorn does, right?
Exactly.
I didn't let it blow up enough so that when I rebaked it, you know, I cooked the rice on the side with the dried mushrooms and the stock. When I rebaked it, it almost comes out a little tough because it dehydrates a little bit in the oven as you're rebaking. So I didn't quite give it enough bloom the first time out as a base rice,
right,
as I would the next time if I did. I would have cooked it with maybe another half to a cup of stock and let all that or most of the rice kernels bloom out of their
rice is nothing to do with regular rice. It's much different in terms of
it's grass,
cooking
basically.
It. Yeah, you have to cook it all the way and let it bloom. That's how you get all the flavor and tenderness.
Tenderness is I think, the key there. So, yeah, just great fun getting ready for my class. If you want to join our class, it's hotstovesociety.com, and you can sign up for my Thanksgiving bundle, or you can sign up for individual classes. They're only $30. So what is it, $25, $30? I don't remember what they are, but they're not super.
And you can buy a box, and you can.
Oh, dinner's a whole other story. We can make you dinner. You don't even have to cook. All right, we got so much more to do. Up next, it's kitchen essentials. We're going to talk about the tools that are essential for your kitchen for the holidays. On Cairo Radio, it's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Welcome back. It's the Hot Stove Society.
I'm Terry Rotiro, the chef in the hat.
You certainly are, sir. And I am Tom Douglas. Happy to be here. We are here every week, Saturdays and Sundays, especially when the football game is not playing. But you can always find us online.
Which is
on
never.
Podcast. Okay. So we're going to talk kitchen essentials. You and I have probably a few different opinions, but probably some similar opinions on kitchen essentials to get you through the holiday season, things that you may or may not have. So I'm going to assume, Chef, that we all have a knife, right? We all have a cutting board. We all have a whisk, a spatula. I think the intention here...
Hold on, because I've been in many kitchens just like you have. And the whisk, I'm going to argue that one, because I have seen a lot of lame...
They have lame whisk.
A three-branch whisk. I'm like, what do you do with that?
Yes. But as we know in the restaurant business, when you have tools, you don't just have a whisk, right? You have a whisk that's a balloon whisk for whipped cream or egg whites, right? You have another whisk that works better.
A hard whisk for heavy sauces.
Right? And then you have a nice light whisk when you're just making a little... Beurre Blanc or something of that nature. So same thing goes with ice cream scoops, right?
Right.
In our world, they double as a portion.
Correct.
A portioner. So in my kitchen at home, for example, I have a 1 ounce, 2 ounce, 3 ounce, and 4 ounce ice cream scoop.
Yeah.
And it helps me, like, you know, when I'm making crab cakes, when I'm making cookies.
Stuffing. We're talking about stuffing earlier.
Yeah.
If you want to measure your stuffing and you want to put it on the... It's everybody's plate, the same amount. You know, you can do that. You can use a scooper.
Yeah, sure. Okay, I'm going to skip that one. So you know, stainless steel spoons, right? Wood spoons have different. I love the wood. I use most of my wood spoons, you know, I say that with parentheses, is the flat edge one.
Me too.
Yeah, I use that a lot.
I'm not a big fan. I've shied away from the spoon. I used to use spoon a long time ago. But I much more prefer the flat spatula. It's more like a wood spatula.
Yeah.
Carved where the bottom is really flat, so you can actually scrape the bottom of the pan and the bottom of the pot whenever you're doing a stew or whatever.
Yeah, I like that tool.
Me too. More than a spoon, I use that more than a spoon.
So let's assume that the kitchen, everybody's kitchen has a little bit of variety of that. In the more exotic areas, like, do you think every kitchen needs to have a mandolin?
Well, it depends how your knife skills are and how much you like your fingers. Those two things are very important. Your knife skill, if they're not very good, a mandolin is great because it will julienne anything very evenly and quite fairly fast once you know how to use the mandolin. The danger with the mandolin is don't ever underestimate the enemy in this one, because the mandolin is treacherous and does not forgive. When it cuts... It cuts really good.
It cuts really good because you're putting pressure on it.
Correct.
And a lot of people are too macho to use the guard, right? The safety guard.
That's right.
Right.
So use the guard and don't be shy about having a leftover piece of carrots just because you have that.
Right.
Use that for your stock.
You use for stock. Exactly.
Yeah, or your soup or whatever. Mm-hmm. But don't be worried about that. Worry more about your fingers. Mm-hmm. Now back to a mandolin. I think a mandolin is a great tool. just to go back to the different sizes, and you can do, if you have the two or three different blades that goes to it, especially the nice little Japanese mandolin, those are easy. They're not a very high investment, but they're a very good investment.
I bought my mandolin at the Puyallup Fair, where they were selling, you got two for $25.
Ooh.
Yeah, and they were called D-slicers, you know. It was.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I remember
and
that.
And they literally are two opposing razor blades. And so if you don't use your guard, you are in serious trouble.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah.
I've made many, many, many lines in the palm of my hand many times.
Yeah. Okay, so we're saying that an inexpensive mandolin is probably, the $150 ones aren't really necessary for the home kitchen.
No, no, I think
but they make them for $25. Yeah. Yeah, you can buy them at Wajimaya, you can buy them at the fair.
Yeah.
Okay, what about food processor?
Well, we just went, Kathy, my wife, never makes pastry dough. She always like, it's too complicated. She never makes it. The other day we were talking and I'm like, well, why don't you just use a food processor? It's a revelation.
Oh, really? She's a
She's
new
like,
woman.
Oh, my God. It's so easy. I was like, okay, so the food processor, I think, is a good item. To me, I like the food processor. I also like the Vitamix blender.
Uh-huh.
But that's an expensive tool. But the food processor is a great step for any kind of puree, or anything that you want to really pulverize.
Uh-huh.
It's a great way to start, and it's very multifunctional.
I would say that's the only time that I use that is when I'm making a big batch or something. Let's say I'm making a big batch of antipasto or I'm making a big batch of pepperonata. Then I might use the food processor.
If you have a recipe that calls for something to be pulsed, can you do something else if you do not have a food processor at home?
You can use a blender.
A blender?
You just have to, the difference
just
between
put your finger on your wrist while you're chopping and you can have a pulse.
Check your pulse. No, the difference between the blender and the food processor for me is in if you're going to use the same product to get the same product out of a blender than you would for a food processor, you got to use batches smaller. Because the food processor is more cylindric, so
To be wet. In the blender, it has to be wet.
Correct. And it also starts with a very low base, very small base. The food processor is a wider base, so it allows things to go around and then to mix. Where in the food processor, in the Vitamix or the blender, it comes from the bottom and it goes up, so it spirals everything up. So if you don't have any juice in there, you need to add juice. And if you have a lot, you need to do smaller batches. So that's the only difference.
Yeah.
But the Vitamix will blend anything even further than the food processor.
Yeah, but it'll puree things before. Like if you're trying to chop onions in it, it'll puree it before you.
You can't use the blender to chop onion. No.
Okay. Now, what about a separate spice grinder compared to, say, a mortar and pestle?
I have both in my kitchen.
But I don't use them.
I know. I use the spice grinder more than I use the pestle.
See, I'm the opposite. I use the mortar and pestle.
Because I use the pestle mostly for. Actually, that's not true. I use a pestle for a few things. So. I like to crush like coriander, and if I'm doing coriander, I actually won't reach for the actual coffee grinder or the spice grinder. I will use the pestle more often because I don't work in big batches at home.
Well, and there's also the idea that, okay, if you do coriander seed in your spice grinder, then you really, if you're going to do cinnamon next, you really have to clean it out, whereas the mortar and pestle is so easy to wipe out and clean up. And
right.
So from that perspective, for me, that's why I like it better.
And I also think that, back to what I was saying, if you do small volume at home, the mortar and pestle is more than fine.
Yeah.
If you do big volume, it's a little bit different. So if you need to do a lot of, if you're doing curing of some kind or, you know, you need to grind a lot of spices, then spice grinder would be helpful.
Okay, so here's a big one, because it takes a lot of room in the kitchen. And just to be clear, we are sponsored here at the Hot Stove by KitchenAid, but I've always had one. Would you invest in the KitchenAid to take up all that counter space in your kitchen compared to, say, one of those little hand blenders that lives in the drawer and you pull it out? Because honestly, outside of the holidays, you just don't use it a ton.
So we have a KitchenAid in the house.
Uh-huh.
It's in the basement because I don't want to keep it on the counter because we don't use it enough. And
It's in my basement.
That
is a beautiful piece of machinery, and you're hiding it in the basement.
It is. I'm not trying to showcase my tools. I'm trying to use them.
It's like having a Ferrari.
Yeah, you keep it in the garage, not outside. Under an alarm secured.
Okay, so you're saying it's worth having the KitchenAid, even if you can't fit it into your kitchen.
Well, it's worth having it. Hold on, I wasn't finished with that.
Okay.
My wife always still use the The beater, you know, the egg beater. That's what she uses.
The hand one?
Yeah. She always uses that. I keep trying to tell her, we have a beautiful kitchenette downstairs.
What? And she goes, but you don't use it because you put it in the basement. It's hard. It's too much trouble.
Yes, I agree with that in some ways, but still, it's a very expensive piece of equipment to have on the counter and not use it. So I still think that a KitchenAid is a great tool in the kitchen. Yeah. That's what I think, as a chef.
Okay, now,
because you can grind.
There's one my daughter and I argue about all the time, because most people have limited counter space.
Yes.
This new air fryer thing. Loretta, are you here yet? She's going to join us in Food for Thought Trivia, but I thought I would have this because I did an expose of the air fryer on Evening Magazine, one of our evening show. I'm not allowed to call it that. The evening show, and I did them next to each other, the convection oven next to the air fryer, which is kind of an intense convection oven. And frankly, it's not worth my counter space. Loretta, do you have a difference of opinion? Because your kitchen is a quarter the size of my kitchen.
Yeah, I love my air fryer. I mean, it's just... I'm almost always cooking for only two, and it's small. It heats up much, much faster than my oven. And I also think you're kind of taking for granted that people have convection ovens in their home, and a lot of people don't. And getting that kind of crisp outside and quicker cooking, you know, is the advantage of the air fryer for people.
So you're saying you don't really need an air fryer?
I'm saying you do.
I'm saying
if you don't have a convection oven, and if you want to speed up your cooking, your heat up time. I mean, I do salmon, pork chops, potatoes, Brussels sprouts. Anything I would roast in the oven, I roast in.
You know, you're not supposed to eat that much fried food. They call it an air fryer.
Well, it uses the convection heat, not oil, so it's not.
Yeah, and I'm with you. I think when you have no space, it's much, and you're only two people, it's easier to just take a small oven. Like a mini oven or an air fryer than it is to warm up an oven.
They have a lot now that are like toaster, oven, air fryer combos. So, you know, if you're limited on space, I think it's great.
Right.
Okay, fine.
Multifunctional and practical.
We're going to have to rip her to shreds in the next segment.
That's your job. It's your daughter.
I know. But we don't take any prisoners with Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. That's coming up here on Cairo Radio. It's the Hot Stove Society Show, 97.3 FM. Time for Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on the Hot Stove Society Show on Cairo. Our formidable challengers are here. One is Chef Terry in the Chapeau. How are you feeling today, Chef?
I'm feeling great.
Good. And our other is the one and only, quite literally...
The quite and only daughter you have.
Daughter that I have, who may or may not disown me after this segment. Depends on how bad we beat her down. You know, she's an attorney, so she's a smarty pants.
I'm going to wash my feathers.
Don't get too out of line.
Don't get too out of line. Our tasty trivia is brought to you by Rub With Love, a handcrafted, versatile rub, sauces, and mustards that I've been making for 22 years now. It adds a great flavor to any meat, fish, or vegetable. Look for Rub With Love products in your local grocery store, Bartels, butcher shops, or find them online at tomdouglas.com or My Buddy Stan or Amazon or Costco or... Your house. You can find them anywhere. They're delicious. Maddie, who's playing today, and how do we play the game?
Okay, we are playing for listener and also Facebook Live listener, Susie Brown Ruth. She actually is very grateful for you guys cooking up that squash. She has some in her fridge, and so she's going to be inspired here by your salad.
Practice her knife skills.
And her knife skills, exactly. She's going to receive a November flavor trio with a jar of our peri-peri rub, our pork rub, and a jar of the toasted shallot mustard that you used today in the dressing. So she will win that.
And I believe I also offered a signed copy of Tom's Big Dinners.
Oh, there she go. An
to go
added
along
bonus.
With that three-pack. Yeah.
Even better.
Because of the King Belita stuffing.
Wow.
Recipe.
It's true. So we are going to do three rounds, five questions each. Thierry is going to go first, and whoever gets the most questions right gets to send the bill for shipping to Tom.
I love it. Hey, I want to give a quick shout-out to a good friend of mine, Alan Wong, in Hawaii, in Honolulu, who just closed his restaurant after 25 years, very sadly.
That's a good restaurant,
Big salute to Alan Wong and all he's done for promoting Hawaiian food. I think he's... One of my heroes.
He's not going anywhere. He's a go-getter.
Oh, yeah. But you know, closing Allen Wong's after 25 years.
Wish we were all in Hawaii right now.
Yeah, no kidding.
No kidding.
Much, they probably wouldn't be closing.
Yeah, we would stay there. We'll just camp out. All right, Thierry, you are up first. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I will preface. Now, we are going to continue over from our previous segment. This trivia is all about kitchen tools and gadgets.
I'll try to be good.
Okay. Your first question. What is a percolator used to make?
Used to check to see if there's water in the ground.
That was my first thought when she said percolator. But I would say juice.
No, it is actually coffee. A percolator is a covered pot with boiling water in a central tube used to brew coffee. All right, your next question. What does a salad shooter do?
A salad shooter.
Now, there's one of those kitchen essentials.
I'm going to guess that it is a salad spinner.
It is not. It quickly slices and shreds fruit and veggies to simplify salad making.
But it has a trigger, and it comes out. You know, you put the stuff in the top, and it comes out as a shooter.
Have you ever used one?
No, but I remember the commercials.
Oh, yeah.
Somebody was up too late watching infomercials.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. All right, your third question. What type of egg would be most likely to be served in an egg cup?
A soft-boiled egg.
That is correct. Soft-boiled egg is typically served in there, which holds the egg upright and in place so you can access the creamy yolk inside.
Very commonly served in bars in France, in cafes. You order a soft-boiled egg, and it comes right there in your little cocotier, and you tap with your spoon and eat with some toasted bread.
Why does brown sugar typically harden?
You know, that's a very good question. Yesterday, I had a 20-pound bag, then I actually undid from being very, very hot. I would say it runs out of moisture because that would be my first guess.
Yeah, I'll give that to you. Exposure to air causes brown sugar to harden. I'll give you that to you.
Yep.
Even Tom disagrees, but
I don't disagree.
This utensil lets you take out pieces of chicken from a pot of soup without scooping up the broth. What utensil is it?
Hand strainer. What do you call that?
Ladle, maybe?
Spider.
A slotted spoon.
It's a slotted spoon to take pieces of chicken. They better be small pieces of chicken.
Take out pieces of chicken from a pot without scooping up the broth, though.
Yeah, I get it.
It needs to be slotted. It can't be a ladle.
I was using my spider, which is the bigger.
Sure, it's a larger.
You know,
I'll
because
give that
the
to
pieces
you.
Of chicken are a little bit bigger than that.
All right. You are 3 out of 5.
Oosh, nah.
Maybe I'll 2.5.
Yeah, 2.5. 2.25.
2.25. All right, Loretta, you're up next. True or false, the Lazy Susan was invented in the 20th century.
I think Susan's been lazier longer than
false.
That.
False.
Correct. This handy kitchen server dates back to at least the 1720s, though it didn't get its sluggish name until around 1917. What do you call a baking pan with a fluted center and a round turban-like shape?
A bundt?
Correct, bundt pan.
Oh, nice.
It hit the store shelves in the 1950s and allows you to create round cakes with holes in the center. You are 2 for 2, Loretta.
Better watch out, guys.
All right.
I'm already worried.
Thierry's all about whisks that you have in your house. What type of whisk should you use to make your cream extra fluffy, flat or round?
Round.
Correct. Whisk adds air to cream or eggs.
What's a flat whisk?
What is it?
Are used to make... It's flatter whisks are used to make sauces. You don't think that's true? I think it's
flat
true.
Flat whisk.
Just
flatter.
Go with it. It's
flatter.
Fine.
Flatter.
They're not called round whisks. They're called balloon whisks.
No, I was like, go with it. Go with it.
Round or balloon. All right. Question 4. When did the first stand mixer hit store shelves? 1919, 1949, or 1979?
49. It feels like kind of a 50s-y.
You are false. It's 1919, actually.
Wow.
And it is also still the most registered four item for weddings in the United States.
It's a stand mixer.
Stand mixer. This is often used to level food items such as flour and sugar.
I use the back of my knife.
Yeah, I know. That's what I would use, too.
Or an offset spatula.
Spatula, yeah.
A straight edge spatula.
Yeah.
Yes. Give you half point there. All right, you are in the lead, though, still, with 4 out of 5. Tom, which of the following do you need an aerator for? Wine, coffee, or soda? Or juice? Thierry.
An aerator would be wine.
Correct. When the earliest slow cooker hit the market, what was it designed to cook? Meat, beans, or potatoes?
Meat, beans, or potatoes. I'm going to say beans.
Me that too. Is correct. The earliest slow cooker was Naxon Beanery, which came out in the 1950s. It found mainstream success after it was rebranded to the Crock-Pot and sold 3.7 million units in 1975 alone.
Wow. What?
That's
like
a lot.
For dry beans?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This utensil resembles a mallet with a short handle and dual heads. One of the face of the tool is flat, while the other has rows of pyramid-shaped bumps. What is it?
It's a meat hammer. And extra credit, do you know why it has the pyramid-shaped bumps? Well, you've got the flat side for like scallopini or thin meats. Like that, and the heavier side for more tough cuts, which actually breaks the cartilage and the fat and things.
Dual purpose, two for one. Yeah. I like it. All right, you are going to cut up a whole chicken. What is the best knife to use?
They might say chef knife, but I like a boning knife.
What about a butcher's knife?
That's what a boning knife is.
All right. Time for the egg wash to be brushed on top of rolls for a nice brown finish. What are you going to use to do that?
So my guess is this can't be as simple as a pastry brush. You're going to come up. It is?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Pastry brush.
Trying to make it simple for you.
Yeah, no kidding.
I know. It's hard.
Five
it's
out of five.
Yeah, Tom wins his first one.
First win since Maddie took over writing the quiz. Can you imagine?
Those were some gimmies somebody's been getting talking to off the air.
Maddie's
that is Loretta Douglas chiming in, legal counsel for Tom Douglas Restaurants or Tom Douglas Seattle Kitchen. So she doesn't remember where her check is signed from.
She signs her own.
When was the last time you signed a check?
All right. Well, then who won our prize?
Our Susie Brown Ruth is our listener on Facebook, and she is going to receive that flavor trio. And because you won, Tom, you get to send it to her. Yay, along I'm with so, a book.
So excited. If you want to be part of the Brown, part of the show like Susie, you can join our community on Facebook at Hot Stove Society Radio Show. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Show is produced by Madeline Dow Pennington and Amy Richardson. Sound and production by Sean McFadden. And our editor is Sean, don't call me Del Torre. Remember, if you miss any episode of Hot Stove Society show on Cairo 97.3, you can listen via podcast. Just subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app.
Thanks for listening and have a fabulous weekend.